Okay, let's go ahead and get started. If you'll come on in and have a seat, find a spot here that's comfortable where you can hear what's going on. I'll maybe back this up a touch. Dave Perkins is going to, who you met a couple of weeks ago, or last week, I guess. Was that how, it was just a week ago, right? We'll be introducing our guests, so I won't do that. Just a word to say that all these events are going to be podcast. I think the first one is already up, and we're hoping to get the Sherry's up real soon. And so if you want to tell other folks about it, they can go to the Vanderbilt website and hear our conversations together. Just so for the sake of the podcast, to say this this series of events is sponsored by a new program here at the Divinity School that we hope to keep around for a while, a program in religion in the arts and contemporary culture. And the title of this series of events is Like a Prayer, Popular Music and Religious Identity. And we've got a great list coming up, so I hope anyone out there in podcast land who happens to get this will come and attend. I'm going to turn it over to Dave Perkins, who will introduce our guest for tonight.
First, I want to just say thank you to John Still for his kindness and generosity and being with us tonight. The Gospel Music Association is a nexus of sorts that facilitates communication between record labels, recording artists, publishers, and the consumers of contemporary Christian and gospel musics. It's also the center of the universe for advocacy for the industry. With the annual Dove Awards, the GMA helps establish the standards by which the music and the activities of the industry are judged successful. As such, the GMA is a center point for the contemporary Christian music industry. John Still comes this evening as the CEO of the Gospel Music Association. However, John also brings with him years of experience as head of CCM, Contemporary Christian Music Magazine. Arguably more than any other publication, or I would have to say institution, CCM Magazine created the culture of Christian music. To compare the social and cultural role of the magazine to that of Rolling Stone in the 70s is not a stretch. So to speak to the workings, the history, and the future of the CCM gospel music industry, there are few whose background and knowledge equal that of our speaker this evening. So if you would, make welcome John Still.
So are you saying everything's my fault? Is that what this is about? Hey, everyone. It's so good to see you. It's good to be here. Looking forward to an engaging time. And, John, that was a very PBS-style introduction, I thought. This is perfect for the podcast. And
doing my best.
And I'm here to completely screw it all up. So, well, I would really love for, and thank you, Dave. That was a really nice introduction. I'd like to... That was very nice.
You want to frame it?
Yeah, something like that. You usually don't have intellectuals introducing me, and it's like, you know, here's this person. Anyway, I've been asked to come, and I saw the title, The World of Contemporary Christian Music, An Insider's View. So you know what? I guess we'll just talk about it and whatever you want to talk about. I'd love for this to be a very interactive session with you. I'd love for you to ask any questions you want to ask. Challenge anything you want to challenge, factually, philosophically, whatever. You won't hurt my feelings. I got over that a long time ago. There are so many different points of view, you know, about even talking about that phrase that CCM Magazine sort of created the culture of contemporary Christian music. We never intended to do that, and it was sort of an embarrassing byproduct, honestly. If there was a subculture created, because we never didn't want it to ever be a subculture and don't believe it should be, but it is. So stuff happens. But I think it's important to get some perspective on this aspect of music to understand where it has come from, to go back to the very beginnings of it. Because if you just take a snapshot of today without the moorings of the beginnings of it, to understand the original intent of the people who kind of happened into it, I think it's you really miss something. So if you'll go back with me, and I know most of you probably weren't actually there, some of you were, in the 60s. Contemporary Christian music was born out of the music of the 60s. Arguably the best period of pop music and rock music ever. I mean, just think about what was happening then. On the top 40 chart, you had the Beatles and the Stones and the Doors and Jimi Hendrix and Henry Mancini and everything all mixed together at the time. It was really a weird time for pop music, but there was some incredible, you know, Creedence Clearwater came out then, Led Zeppelin, Larry Norman, and the war in Vietnam was raging. People, particularly college students, were much more upset about the war in Vietnam than they are about the war in Iraq. And there were very intense protests taking place. And it created this stew. Protest music came out of the 60s. People protesting what was going on in the culture. It was a completely new paradigm musically. It was a completely new paradigm philosophically. And the hippie movement was born. And it's tune in, turn on, drop out. They were walking around with guns with flowers in the barrel, and they were, you know, doing the peace signs and the music festivals, Woodstock being the apex of that in 1969, I think that was. But also, there was a backlash to that. People became disillusioned. And there was a church in Southern California called Calvary Chapel that... And I don't exactly know how this happened, but they started to accept the hippies who were looking for something deeper than the free love movement. They found that free love wasn't really free, and maybe it wasn't even really love. And they were looking for real love, and this church opened their doors, and a lot of them found Jesus. They discovered religion. And it became a... It hit some kind of a tipping point, where you go to this church, and it became known in Orange County, California, where this was, you could show up in jeans. Now, showing up at church in jeans was a radical idea in the 60s. You went to church like this, or with a tie on. And I'm sorry about this. I had a board meeting today. Otherwise, I'd be wearing jeans. And you could go barefoot, and it was okay. And the people who came out of that hippie world who were musicians were encouraged to make the music they knew. And they didn't come out of that world automatically knowing how to wear a choir robe and play an organ, which was what most of the music in the church was, classical church music. So they started bringing guitars and just writing these new songs about their faith. Most of them were evangelistic in nature, lyrically, or testimonies about how their life had changed. But they were done with the guitar, and some people formed these little bands. They were kind of like folk rock bands. They weren't so much hard rock bands, although there were a few. And this new thing began. It was never an industry. In fact, you couldn't do it to make money. You have a lot of young people, 18, 19, 20 years old, just playing wherever they could, motivated by their new faith and their desire to share that. And that's really where it began. The notion, it wasn't music in the church, although Calvary Chapel began to allow these artists to perform there. Groups like Love Song was one of the first really kind of big bands at that time. Larry Norman was just a hippie who came to Christ, made an album for Capitol Records called Upon This Rock, which is one of the very first contemporary Christian albums. Interestingly, on Capitol Records, not on a contemporary Christian label. There's a really good reason for that. There weren't any contemporary Christian labels at the time. That came later as more and more artists began to come to grips with the idea that, you know, we can express our faith in sort of a culturally relevant way. You know, it wasn't very good. It wasn't well produced. They had no budgets. But some of these people started making records. Larry Norman, Randy Stonehill, a guy named John Fisher, who wrote for us for CCM Magazine for many years, was one of the very first albums. He put an album out called The Cold Cathedral on FEL Records, which was a religious label called, and FEL stands for Friends of the English Liturgy. I thought that was really a weird thing. But there was a purity about this that was really pretty refreshing, in that, like I said, they weren't trying to make money, they weren't trying to be an industry. It was a movement, pure and simple. And it was a very pure thing. Then, as more and more people caught on, labels started to form. Calvary Chapel started their own label called Maranatha Music. And all these bands that had formed, The Way, Children of the Day, Parable, Sweet Comfort Band, Mustard Seed Faith, that were starting to get real popular in the Southern California Calvary Chapel circuit, because Calvary Chapel started to replicate all over the place, and these bands found a home. And then a local theme park called Knott's Berry Farm started doing these Christian music nights. This is in the early 70s, and they were huge. They would draw 10,000 people to come and hear these new rock bands play Christian music. Such a novelty, because when you said Christian music, that meant choir or something more inspirational, George Beverly Shea kind of, you know, Billy Graham crusade sort of person. And it was really fascinating to people. Just preceding this movement was something called the Youth Musicals. Ralph Carmichael, Kurt Kaiser were a couple of the composers of these. These came out in the mid-60s, 66, 67, 68. They were intended to be done by youth group choirs in churches. And they were intended to be contemporary music. The thing that was funny about that is all the kids who performed really hated them, because it wasn't really their music, but it was what you could get away with in church with your parents. And they thought, oh man, the kids are doing their really hip, cool thing, that's great. And there was a guy named Billy Ray Hearn who was hired by Word Records to go promote these youth musicals all over the country. He was a music minister at the time, and he sensed a real change going on in music and started the label called Myrrh at Word Records in Waco, Texas, which was the premier sort of religious products company. They did books, and they had one of the first spoken word recordings out there in the Christian space in 1951 by the founder, Gerald McCracken, called The Game of Life. Well, Billy Ray signed, Petra was one of his first signings, one of the early Christian rock groups. They had one called Crimson Bridge, which was sort of a Chicago knockoff, the early Chicago knockoff. They had one called First Gear, which was, I don't remember the music that well, but none of it was any good. But the lead singer was Larnell Harris, who went on to become a big inspo singer. He also signed a group out of Southern California called the Second Chapter of Acts. And another guy, former protest singer from the 60s named Barry McGuire, had a big song in the 60s called Eve of Destruction, one of the sort of prototype protest songs from the 60s. And he had become a believer out of this movement, got signed to Myrrh Records, and did a Christian record. Something happened in there when people were doing Christian records with Christian lyrics. They found that really only Christians liked them. And so this real subtle transition took place from people doing music on the streets for all the people to hear, testimonies about their faith and just songs proclaiming the good news, to albums that were really targeted to the church, and yet not really accepted in the church, because it was, after all, rock and roll music, and you can't have rock and roll in the church, oil and water at that time. And that really was the beginning of the subculture, when suddenly you make a record and your whole audience already believes the message you're singing about. You're not really evangelizing per se. And then an absolute flood of stuff started to come out. And honestly, if you went back and listened to it today, most of it was really poorly produced. But because it was such a novelty, people listened to it. I remember in my church youth group when the first Maranatha album came out, it was a compilation of several different groups. There's no real rock and roll. It's mostly acoustic. I remember after church on Sunday night, we were high school kids. High school or even college at that time, college. Wow. Okay. We would play this record vinyl. You know what those are?
Yeah.
Over and over. We were so enthralled by it. It's really awful. If you went back and listened to today, you'd go, how could you listen to that? But it was the thing. It was so new, and it absolutely captured us and captivated us. And I don't know why I have this memory of just listening to the Maranatha One album over and over and over, because we were just like, this is so us. You know, someone understands us and is making music for us. We don't have to listen to our parents' music anymore in church, because we all were looking for authentic ways to express our faith, only we liked rock music. You know, we were all listening to the same music everybody else was. And that's when I sort of caught a vision for needing to improve this music and get it out there a little bit, because I remember driving home from church one day where we had just done one of those Gag Me with a Spoon youth musicals. And get in my car, and on comes the Doors or whatever, and I'm going, okay, wait a minute. There's some incongruity here between my church life and my real life. Why is that? Should that be? I didn't know anything about theology at the time. Many would say I still don't. But I felt like it should not be compartmentalized. Why? Not that you have to do, you know, sing Light My Fire in church, but stylistically, why the gap? And then I began to think about whether life and culture should be compartmentalized like that, and realized that to live an authentic Christian life 24/7, you know, you needed to take all things captive, as the scripture would say. And so I began to find a way to make faith culturally relevant to my generation. And it seemed to me that music was the perfect vehicle to take religious thought, set it in something that's culturally relevant, a language artistically that my generation would understand, and then they would listen to the message. To me, musical styles are like languages. We translate the scripture into all kinds of different languages so all the people in the world can understand it. Well, that's all these different musical styles are. It's just a different language for people to hear it how they like it. I don't know if it's me or what, but I'm getting real warm about this coat. Fast forward a couple years. Myrrh Records is formed in Waco, Texas. Light Records is in Southern California. And they've signed a young black artist named Andre Crouch. They have Andre Crouch and the Disciples. They're actually a really good band. He got on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson a couple times. Not as a novelty act, but like as really good music. Out of the Jesus movement came a lot of religious influence in mainstream culture. At that time, it was not unusual to find Jesus songs on the radio, on mainstream pop radio. One of the biggest hits of 1968, I think it was, maybe 69, was Oh Happy Day by the Edwin Hawkins Singers, a black gospel choir doing an old hymn. It got to number 2 on the Hot 100 on Billboard. Who knew? I mean, it was so left field, but it was part of the zeitgeist. You know, at that time, that was where it was. You had all these people. Cat Stevens had did Morning Has Broken, kind of an old English hymn that became a big hit. And then you had Jesus Christ Superstar, the musical that came out. Godspell came out. These things were all enormously popular. Judy Collins had an a cappella version of Amazing Grace that was a big radio hit. Has anybody ever heard that? Would anybody think, yeah, they'll play that on the river?
No.
No. But that's what was going on. Put Your Hand in the Hand by Ocean. All these sort of like overt, they weren't trying to be cool, they were overt Christian songs. And then you got kind of the goofy ones like Damn It Isn't God's Last Name and stuff like that. But it's lots of stuff that went on. Contemporary Christian music, as it really wasn't known yet then, it was known as Jesus music in its earliest phase, was not headquartered in Nashville. The epicenter was Southern California. But in Nashville, in about 1976, the Benson Company, which is the oldest music publisher in Nashville, by the way, started a label called Green Tree Records, and they signed Reba Rambo, who'd been in a Southern gospel group, putting out some contemporary music, and they signed some other people. It was a decidedly different sound than what was coming out of Southern California, but it caught hold in the Southeast, in Southern Baptist churches and Pentecostal churches, and then a label called Tempo started up in Kansas City. Star Song started up in Houston, Texas. Star Song was a much more contemporary label than some of the others. Fast forward to 1976. Billy Ray Hearn, Word Records, the Word Company, got purchased by ABC. ABC Television, who had a publishing company and all that kind of stuff. And Billy Ray didn't want to have secular ownership over his label, so he got a company to invest some money, and he started Sparrow Records, moved to Southern California, and signed some of his former Murr artists, like Barry McGuire, Annie Herring, who was the lead singer of Second Chapter of Acts, John Michael Talbot and Terry Talbot, and this new kid from Southern California named Keith Green. Were part of his initial roster on Sparrow Records. In the later years, in the late 80s and early 90s, there's a lot of talk about how mainstream companies were taking over Christian music. In fact, our big three that we have today, all based here in Nashville, are all owned by mainstream conglomerates, if you will. But that's not a new thing, because Word was taken over by ABC in 1975, well ahead of the curve. So we have a new label in Southern California called Sparrow. Light Records is continuing to put out lots of music. And I was involved in doing radio programs and production, and actually did some work with Sparrow Records, was sort of the voice of Sparrow, doing all their commercials and in-store specials and radio specials and that kind of thing. And got involved with some guys who had a local tabloid newspaper in Southern California called Contemporary Christian Acts, ACTS. You guys have probably seen some of the tabloids, the Christian tabloids that exist in certain cities. Maybe you have one where you live. They're generally not great journalism. They have a lot of syndicated articles and all that kind of stuff. Well, this was one of the early ones called Contemporary Christian Acts, and it had a section on sports and family and music, and it's all for Orange County Christian community. Well, I became the editor of the music section, not because I knew anything about any of this, although I did take some majored in mass communications, so I had journalism classes so I could write, but I knew the artist because I interviewed him for a radio show that I was doing. And I became the editor of the music section, kind of because I was there and sort of by default because nobody else would do it. And after about a year, my partners and I came to the conclusion that the music section could be its own publication, a whole separate publication just about music. And so I went around the country and talked to the different record labels in 1977. And so my visit did take me to Nashville, but it took me to Kansas City, and it took me all over Southern California and different places and down to Houston. But I remember going to Word, and one of my friends there played me a reel-to-reel tape of a new band, and it was the hardest Christian rock I had ever heard. I mean, it was like smoking hot, hard music. I said, wow, that is awesome. Are you guys going to sign that? I said, no way. They wouldn't touch it. It was just way too progressive. Well, Star Song signed that band. Rez Band, Resurrection Band, was their first album that he was playing me. Anybody ever heard of Rez Band? They're out of another enclave of the Christian community in Chicago, Jesus People USA, Cornerstone Festival. That same group puts that on today. Rez Band, Glenn Kaiser and them came out of that group. But even at that time, in 1977... hard Christian music was sort of not there yet. You just couldn't go there. Because the big argument at the time, Christian music was very, very, contemporary Christian music was very, very controversial. Because people thought the drums came from Africa and that was somehow of the devil. Never quite understood that, but it was incongruent with the Christian message and Christian thought. And you had a lot of people talking about how the beat is so bad for you, and this music is antithetical to the gospel and all that kind of stuff. So there are a lot of televangelists and others who are really out there pounding hard on this. And one guy named Bob Larson, wrote a whole book called The Day the Music Died. Now, he had been a former rock guitarist, and he knew how it really was, and this stuff was evil. And to his credit, a few years later, he said, you know what, I think it's okay. All these predictions I made about what was going to happen to all the young people if they listened to this trash didn't happen. And he totally reversed his position about it. And that is no longer an argument today. Well, you can still find some websites. But you can find a website supporting any position about anything if you want. But that is no longer a big issue with this. Back to the magazine scenario. We decided to take this music section and make its own publication. So instead of Contemporary Christian Acts, we removed acts and put music and called it Contemporary Christian Music. It seemed like the right thing to call it. We weren't trying to name anything, and I'm sure we'd heard people call it that before, but that became the name of the publication. And it was literally a copycat from Contemporary Christian Acts. We copied all the fonts, all the design. It was an exact clone of Contemporary Christian Acts. Instead of sections on family and sports and stuff, it had sections on retailing and, you know, new releases and talent and record reviews and all that kind of stuff. And it was a newspaper. First issue came out in the middle of 1978. And I didn't know it at the time. I had no idea what it would do or the effect it would have. We were just sort of thought we could do this thing and capitalize on what was going on. In doing a publication, you should never think in terms of capitalizing on something, because it's the millionaire rule. How to be a millionaire in music or in publishing, start with $2 million. And yeah, because you can lose a lot of money fast. But what we ended up doing is documenting the movement. We just told the story about what is. We had some, and I think one of the things that was different about us, and we had some precursors. There was a publication called Harmony that preceded us. We were just trying to tell the story of what was happening. We were kind of like Fox News. We report, you decide. We reported the good, the bad, and the ugly in as neutral of a way as we could, as unbiased of a way as we could, because we felt like even if something sort of bad happened, if there's bad news, if we reported it, people could learn from that, because our goal was to help improve the industry, so to speak, which was rapidly growing. In 1975, how many Christian music radio stations do you think there were? Do you know how many there are today? Hundreds and hundreds.
None.
Gold star for you. There were none. First one came on in Lincoln, Nebraska, called KBHL, Kept by His Love. And then KYMS signed on in Orange County, California, where we were. It was a hard rock station, and they switched over one day. Used the same DJs were there, mispronouncing all these artists. They had no idea about this music they were playing. It was quite comical, actually, in some cases. And the station had some uncomfortable transitions, but that was really the beginning of full-time music Christian radio, which, of course, is a big sales engine for selling radio. And that, a lot of fits and starts, but now Christian music as a full-time format is a really big deal in the Christian radio world. K-Love and Air One are two of the major networks. These guys are sophisticated. They research the music to death. They understand who their listener is, which is now a very narrowly defined target. And it really looks today completely different than it did in the beginning. Skipping over a lot of years now, kind of fast forwarding today, because everything happened. Tooth and Nail Records came online, making Res Band seem really tame. Out of Seattle, some of you are probably familiar with Tooth and Nail and the bands that they have. Living, you know, kind of right on the edge. So as it's grown, it's given rise to all kinds of questions and tension points. One of my favorite ways a person would write a letter to the editor was, if the purpose of Christian music is, and fill in their blank, and there's probably 100 different purposes, everything they see or hear is judged by what they think the purpose of Christian music is. For example, if the purpose of Christian music is to reach the lost, then whatever so-and-so is doing over here is really, like, not happening. Or if the purpose of Christian music is to edify the saints, then Amy Grant crossing over, I mean, what is she thinking? You know, going to top 40 radio, selling out like that, how can you do that and still call yourself a Christian? The variety of points of view will give you a headache. You've got this matrix of all these different musical styles and all these agendas. Some people think music's to reach the lost. Some people think it's to evangelize the saints. Some people think it's to praise God. Some people think it's just your personal expression of whatever. And you overlay that on what the Methodists think you should be doing and what the Pentecostals think you should be doing and what the Southern Baptists think you should be doing, and you've got a really confusing matrix here and no consensus. And that's the world that we live in today, and that's the world that still exists today, I think in many cases. It gives rise to a number of tension points that exist now in the world of Christian music, which you can translate to any number of worlds. Art versus commerce. Entertainment versus ministry. Church audience versus a general audience, because they tend to be mutually exclusive. Do you want to be commercial and successful, or you don't want to be artistic and have integrity? You know, every now and then those lines cross, but it's a rare thing. I think most of us would admit. You've got what's popular versus what's good. Now, who's to say what's popular isn't good? Or who, you know, you can say what's good isn't popular, but these are all tension points that exist in the contemporary Christian music world. Is it too commercial? Is it not commercial enough? Is it just agenda-driven? Is the music any good? The answer is yes and no. There's really bad music in Christian music. There's some really good music. But honestly, there's really bad music in any genre, isn't there? I was telling the guys at dinner tonight, how many albums do you think were released last year? Not in Christian music, just overall. Would anyone hazard a guess? How many do you buy? Or download, legally, I'm sure. 80,000. How many of those are popular? How many of those are good? We know they're obviously not all popular. I think the figure, I may even have it here. About 25% of those were digital only. 80% of all releases sell 100 copies or less. 1,000 titles of those 80,000 produce 80% of all sales on new releases. So that's and so in any genre you have bad stuff and you have really good stuff. Today, Christian music exists in a world dominated by three labels. As you probably know, in the mainstream music world, there's four major labels: Universal Music Group, EMI, Warner Music Group, and Sony BMG. In the Christian music world, there's Sony BMG through Provident label group. Warner Music Group has Word Entertainment over here on Music Row, and EMI has EMI Christian Music Group. Those three labels are responsible for just over 90% of all the Christian music sales. They're all based in Nashville, and almost probably 95% of all Christian, gospel, Southern, whatever, comes out of Nashville-based companies. So Nashville is the epicenter. Sparrow moved here in the early 90s. Word moved here in the early 90s. Tempo went away. Starsong got bought by Sparrow and moved to Nashville. Maranatha is still out there not doing much. They're in Southern California. Light Records is in Nashville now. The only really major label that isn't here is Integrity Music. It's a praise and worship company down in Mobile, Alabama. So it's an industry controlled by the majors with virtually all of the same issues today that mainstream music has, facing declining sales because of piracy. Here's a stat which you may know something about. Music consumption, if you look at 2003 as a baseline, overall, this is overall music, music consumption is up 32% from 2003 in terms of people acquiring music. That's the good news. Bad news, only 42% of it is paid for. Last year, it dropped below 50%. Most of it's being acquired through people burning other people's CDs or using peer-to-peer, illegal peer-to-peer services. So, among teenagers, 80% of all acquisition is unpaid. That's making it really hard for the contemporary Christian music world to survive, because this is an industry at this point whose annual sales peaked in 1999 or 2000, a little over $700 million a year, just to give you the dimensions. It's about 6.5% of the total music business when you take it all together. Contemporary Christian music specifically, if you count praise and worship as part of that, is roughly 75% of all sales. Black gospel is about 20%. There's kids music at 3 or 4% and a couple little things in there. But that's kind of how it shakes out. By comparison, if you're looking at subgenres, it's bigger than New Age, bigger than classical, bigger than jazz. In fact, it's bigger than classical and jazz combined. They're both about 3% of the overall music business. So it's a force to be reckoned with these days. There's money to be made for sure, which then gets into the whole issue of people's motives when they get into it. It's no longer, I just want to sing for Jesus on the street corner. It's, you know, I want a platinum record, man. I want to get out there and be known, have my songs heard. It is, in fact, an industry these days. But it's Christian kids steal music just with higher frequency as anybody else, we have found, unfortunately. As much as we like to tout their morality, it's not showing up in this particular aspect of life. Well, let's see. So this is where we find ourselves today. And contemporary Christian music, in its as its evolution has gone on, has, I think, bifurcated into two different things. When it started, the next phase after the street corner guys who just wanted to share their faith, and you started making records that had some production behind them, and they started selling some music, one of the early groups was Second Chapter of Acts, and I remember having a conversation with them. They wanted to make a record one day that was good enough to get on Top 40 radio. The original intentions of the people who were involved in the artists was to get out there into the mainstream world, to have their message heard by the masses, not just by the Christian community, not just by the church. But over time, because the church audience wanted an explicit Christian message, they became the vast majority of the audience. Most of the lyrics of contemporary Christian music are very exclusive in nature as opposed to inclusive. They use language and terminology that's only understood by church people. They, you know, and it's not necessarily that accessible to the outside world. And if you do make music that is accessible to the outside world, church people don't want it. Generally speaking, there's exceptions to all this stuff, but in general, that's the way it is. If your message is not explicit, it's going to be hard to sell records in this particular marketplace. And if it is explicit, it limits your ability to speak to the culture at large. So what do you do? There's a huge conundrum there that has never been answered and never really effectively dealt with. But today, some interesting things are happening. A lot of these musicians have gone back to doing music for the church, because the church, over time, has assimilated these praise choruses and more contemporary instrumentation. So praise and worship music's a big deal now. That's a big part of the sales. And artists who've lost their record deals are serving in churches as worship leaders, you know, all over the country. And musical style has become a, it's always been, but today especially, what's the term? It's what helps people make their decisions on where to go to church, whether they like the music there or not. And mainline old style churches are losing people to more contemporary style, Saddleback, Willow Creek style churches. And it's a huge problem for the mainline people as they're going, well, do we hold to our standards of what we think is the right thing to do in our worship and have a gray hair congregation or no congregation, small one? Or did we capitulate to the movement? But clearly, the invasion of modern Christian music into the church is pervasive at this point. And that's become the new contemporary Christian music, in my opinion. And now these bands, people who want to speak to the culture, are just speaking to the culture. Like Switchfoot said in a Rolling Stone interview a couple years ago, we're Christians by faith, not by genre. Because contemporary Christian music is not a genre. I don't know if I said this at dinner or if I said it yet here tonight, but you know, other styles like church music, traditional church music, classical church music, southern gospel music, black gospel music, these are styles in and of themselves. You can hear that music without even hearing the lyrics and know what it is. Contemporary Christian music is derivative of pop music and rock music. You don't know that it's Christian music unless the lyrics are plainly heard and very explicitly Christian. And so so now you have bands who want their message to be more inclusive as opposed to exclusive, who just want to make music. They're just not so driven by having to have a Christian message in their songs. So you get more and more bands these days. I suppose a classic example is the tween group, the Jonas Brothers. Everybody knows these kids are Christians. They live clean lives and all that stuff. There's no message in their music. There's certainly a message coming through about their lives, and I would argue they're having more impact on young people than most contemporary Christian bands do, because they're getting to the young people. They're interested in them. They want to hear them. So I think you have more and more people who are just Christians who want to be in a band, as opposed to they want to be a Christian band. So I think it has bifurcated into the praise and worship side and into this side, and much less the contemporary Christian solo artists. Even the ones, you know, Michael W. Smith, one of the biggest artists we have, he's doing pretty much worship music now. The Stephen Curtis Chapmans and Avalons and people who do just basic white bread, pop, straight-ahead Christian music are fewer and further between. And if you look at the best-selling albums, they're mostly compilations, worship compilations or the Wow compilations or some compilation, or it's black gospel that's selling these days. So it's an interesting time of transition. I really don't know where it's going, but I think it's been an interesting evolution from the Jesus movement to today. It's an economically challenged part of the music business. I mentioned radio airplay. Most contemporary Christian music is played on non-commercial radio stations. Non-commercial radio stations pay a fraction of the royalties that commercial stations pay for airplay on music. It's like 20% of what a regular station pays. So if you're a songwriter and you count on radio airplay, you have a big radio hit or number one song in Christian music, it doesn't pay nearly as much as a country music hit would or a pop music hit, because the radio stations that are playing it don't contribute anything to ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC to speak of. So you're challenged on that front. And artists and labels at this time don't get royalties for airplay in America on terrestrial radio at all. That's just, no artists do. That's another discussion. And when these artists go out in concert, the audiences are demanding more and more production. They want it to be as big a show as anybody else they go see. They want the lights, they want the smoke, they want the sound, they want all the razzle-dazzle, which is very expensive. But they certainly don't want to pay the price for that thing. So they might not think about paying $100 to go see the Eagles. They would surely think about paying $100 to go see Jars of Clay. And unfortunately for Jars of Clay and any other Christian band, their buses and their lights and sound cost the same as it costs anybody else. They don't get their diesel at some kind of gospel discount. They have to pay the same rate as everybody else. So their margins that they make on the road are much, much slimmer. It's just much, much harder to make money in Christian music than it is in any other form of music because of these economically challenged things. So people say you're only in it for the money in Christian music, don't really know the economics. Certainly a few people are making money at it, but not anywhere like in country music. In this town, there's a lot of people making a lot of money on country music. Because you get a number one hit, you're going to get a check for $100,000 from ASCAP. Not so in Christian music. Might be $5,000. or 10. It's nothing, not the same at all. So since so much of it is nonprofit and non-commercial, which in some ways that's as it should be, keeps it more pure, keeps it more honest, and you do it because you really feel called to do it as opposed to this is your big opportunity to make money. And there are certainly people who will go into Christian music who would rather be in pop music, but it's easier to make it in Christian music in some ways, to become accepted, because, and you can argue with me about this, but I think the critical standards of Christian audiences are much lower than that of other audiences. I think they're much more accepting. It's much more about the message. If the message is good, we don't care that much about the music. Where in the rest of the world, it's all about the music, just and not so much about the lyrics. So that's one of the key distinctions in Christian music from other forms of music that I think has done a certain amount of violence to the quality of the art. But we can discuss that at your pleasure as we go forward. So anyway, I've kind of laid out for you where it started, where I think it is today, and a little bit about how we got here, skipping over some big parts in the middle as it just grew. And I would invite any comments or questions or any part of discussion you would like to have at this point. Yes?
Can you speak briefly, more about the target demographic and who has kind of been chiseled down into that narrow framework that you made reference to?
Contemporary Christian radio is going after females. They're looking for soccer moms. They call her Becky. It's that specific. That's their archetypical listener. She's 30 to 50, has kids, drives a minivan, and likes having radio that's safe for the whole family. Drive along with the kids. It's driven almost exclusively by females. Now, that's not true of Tooth and Nail. Tooth and Nail's going after college guys, you know, who like their music hard. You'll find something for everybody, but the main part of it is soccer moms, which creates a whole kind of homogenization of, you know, and so what do? If you want to be successful, you want to sell records, you got to get on the radio. If you want to get on the radio, you got to make music that fits that demographic. Isn't that fun? But it's true of pop radio. It's true of country radio. It's not immune, because they found that audience will, there's advertisers who want to reach them, and they will support the advertisers, so they have an economically viable proposition. A radio station designed to reach teenage kids, they can't make any money with it. Yes?
So with people not listening as much to radio or other options, like, can't think of the name of it right now, but on the internet, you can have radio tailored to what you listen to. So if you put in a type, you know, song.
Like Pandora.
Yeah. And things like that, or like Napster, actually, because I do pay for Napster and subscribe to it. They recommend music based on what you download and that kind of thing. I don't listen to radio at all. I get my music based on just kind of coming across it or going searching for music or word of mouth. And I know a lot of other people that are the same way. So how do you, I can see where people are losing money on the radio because people aren't listening to it anymore. So is there like a way that they're going to try and start targeting that, you know, following?
Oh, the labels are absolutely going after every single service like that, every digital service, every internet service. There's lots of internet radio stations. And, of course, you know, for acquisition, all of Christian music is available on iTunes. They've been very, very up on that. But Christian radio is suffering a similar fate as mainstream radio. Terrestrial radio is shrinking. Its audience is shrinking to all these other services. There's so many other ways to acquire music. Satellite radio, if you're in your car. Of course, iPods. I don't listen to terrestrial radio anymore, except if I'm desperate for a traffic report. Yes?
So Saturday night, I went and saw Buddy Miller singing, and Buddy and Julie are obviously, if you don't know, they are excellent, you know, musicians. And he opened with Carry Me, Dead Man, which Jars of Clay on their recent album And here we are in this bar. People are smoking, drinking. It's packed.
What were you doing there? No, I'm kidding.
Having a great time.
Okay,
know?
Good.
I guess my question would be, to me, a lot of it to me, with Buddy Miller, there's an authenticity when he sings Dead Man Carry Me.
Yes.
And he can say, when I die, you know, in your arms I'll be, and there's something really powerful and transcendent about that, even in a bar and beer and smoke. And
maybe especially so.
Right. And so my question is, if and when, and I guess right now I'm asking you, about the delivery of it. Because for me, growing up with Christian music and doing the musicals in church, and I mean, man, I was there. I mean, I grew up Southern Baptist, so there, it was hard to separate that. I became really disillusioned with that because there was a point in my life where it was no longer real. So when I see Buddy Miller in a hat and a t-shirt singing about Jesus in a bar, I'm much more now going to resonate with that. So I'm just curious what you would say to, and again, I know it's also about money and so what sells, and that's just kind of how this world is, but what you would say to that in terms of Buddy Miller singing it and then Jars of Clay singing it. And I love Jars of Clay, but just the difference, and then who Jars of Clay is singing it to. I know there's kind of a roundabout way of saying that. But.
No, I think I get where you're coming from. Your what Buddy and Julie do is great. I agree with you. It's authentic. It's cool. It's also not very commercial.
Right.
Not selling, Buddy Miller doesn't sell very many records.
Right.
He doesn't move the needle there. So he has to be satisfied with living a much lower lifestyle than somebody else who is happy to appeal to your people in your former life as a Southern Baptist who lap that stuff up like, you know, sugar. I use that term on purpose. That's one of those conundrums. And it's not right or wrong, I don't think. I think it's, you know, somebody's got to, you know, appeal to them, I guess. Or you just make a choice. I'm going to do this that appeals to that Southern Baptist crowd, and I'm going to sell a lot more records that way. Wouldn't go so far as to judge someone's motives for wanting to do that, but if they feel called to do that, then that, you know, God bless them. And God bless Buddy Miller for doing what he does. I think there's room for all of it. And I'm thankful that there's Buddy Millers out there. I'm thankful that there's Mike Ferris's out there. And there's other people who do a more gritty, non-commercial. Because just even the sound of that music is not what's going to get played on the radio. K-Love and WayFM are never going to play Buddy Miller. He's too dangerous for them. Because that K-Love audience finds out he played in a bar, he's done.
So how do you reconcile that as the president of DNA? I mean, you can, you know what I mean?
Our job is to support artists in whatever they feel like they want to do. And so we do. I mean, Buddy Miller is eligible for Dove Awards, and we don't pass judgment on their lifestyle choices or any of that. We look at the music. For us, for our Dove Awards process, it's all about the lyrics and the content of the music. It's not about who the artist is, even if they're a believer. Because how can you do that? Then that begs the question of what makes music Christian. Is it the song? Is it the artist? The context? The record label? The sales venue? Their intent? All of the above?
Well, I was going to ask that. That leads right into what I wanted to ask, which is someone like Derek Webb and the sort of the split there from Cademan's Call and obviously a bit of a theological fractioning.
Mm-hmm.
And is someone like him who in some degrees has been sort of blacklisted from some of the from some at least people that I know that are pretty ardent radio listening people. Who determines what theological perspectives get to fall into CCM and what are not? Even though, you know, somebody like Derek Webb may say this is the message I'm trying to get across.
I think the answer to that is ultimately the audience decides. The audience grab. It's not. There's not some like. It's not us. It's not the GMA deciding. Well, you go here and you go here. Although we have categories for our awards, but they're not. It's based purely on the sound of the music and the lyrics, where they go, not the market that they're in or any of that kind of thing. I think the fans, the customers, the consumers decide how this works and where they go. And if they get a label deal, where the label decides to market it and how they market it. there's a lot of artists who want nothing to do. I mean, the term contemporary Christian music or Christian music in general is a pejorative term to a lot of artists and a lot of people. They want, as soon as you're that, I want nothing to do with it. And so they do anything but that. So afraid of being pigeonholed. You know, for the Dove Awards, we have a hard time getting more mainstream people to come on the show because they're afraid of being pigeonholed. Well, they're going to think I'm a Christian artist. I'm Christian music. I don't want to be that. You know, which is really unfortunate. And we try to be broader than just one segment of it, because we're any style. We're all about all the different styles. So the artist also decides where they want to go and what they want to do. And if they want to alienate an audience by taking a certain position, then that's their decision, you know. Yes?
Do you feel a responsibility?
No, go ahead, and then you.
Okay. Do you feel a responsibility to educate your audience? You know, the pastoral position of, we don't get to decide what the preacher's going to talk about in church, but in the music industry, apparently the audience is deciding what counts, which is
ultimately you do in church, because if you all decide to leave the church because you don't want what the pastor's saying, he might think about changing his message.
So how do you balance that role? Do you try to be pastoral?
I think with the magazine, we're a little bit more that way. We really are. We're trying to educate people. Our position there was, we personally didn't like a lot of what we had to do. I mean, we put people on the cover to sell magazines, and our philosophy was, let's give people enough of what they want so that we can give them what we think they need. You know, spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, so to speak. That'd be a song. Wouldn't it be great? Write that. So in that sense, I mean, CCM Magazine started because I hated Christian radio. And I wanted to educate Christian radio and make them better. So we created this. We had columns on programming and stuff because I felt that the gospel would be served by going out and blowing up Christian radio and TV stations. Just get them off the air. It'd be better for the gospel. I'm a little bit of a radical sometimes. But so we've educated them, and I'm happy to say a lot of Christian radio stations these days, you know, The Fish in Atlanta sounds as good as any mainstream station out there. KLTY in Dallas, these are big-time radio stations with big-time sounds and really great-sounding formats. You can argue, quibble with the music, but they're really doing a really good job of radio. They have overcome, they have become what I was hoping they would become. So that's really great. At the GMA, we're not... We only want to educate the audience insofar as we want them to engage with whatever kind of music they like. But we're not trying to tell you what kind of music you should like or what is best. I think it's somewhat of a fruitless pursuit. People are going to like what they like based on other factors than whatever we might say or do. I don't think people care what we say. Is that getting anywhere near?
A little bit.
In other words, no.
Yeah.
Let's go again.
The goal of the lyrics and the message, is it more just telling people what they want to hear because they're going to buy records, or are you actually trying to like make people think about theology? You know, is there a role for that?
I think everything is being done. It's not our role to dictate that or educate people in that, but there are artists who are strictly agenda-driven. I mean, they want to reach the lost or reach the church. Some have very specific theological messages. Some do just want to sell records, and they will write lyrics and do production that they think Christian radio is going to play, because Christian radio plays it, they can sell some records. I mean, that's just what they do. And it's, you know, to me, then you say, well, is that a good motive? Is that a good reason to do it? I think it's okay to want to make a living. And you know what? These people aren't exactly putting out porn or something bad for the culture. It's ultimately probably good for the culture. You could argue that. And when people say, well, you're just doing this for the money, they never say that to me, of course. But, I mean, if theoretically they were to say that to me, my comeback is, well, why do you do your job? Just because you love selling insurance? You love driving that cab? You do it for money. Because you need to make a living. And if this is what you spend all your time doing, I think it's even scriptural. You should make your living doing that. Now, you have to answer to God whether you're pandering you know, to people. Not everybody in Christian music thinks that deeply about it, to be honest. And some are really serious artists who are theologians. The Michael Cards of the world and folks like that are really doing what they do with great intent. Okay, very back and then up here. Yes? Was someone back here first? Oh, you didn't get your question yet. I'm sorry. That is the role of the A&R person at the record label. It's not the role of the GMA to dictate those kinds of things. And I think that's a matter of the artist's own, the kind of music that they do. Because you're not going to get played on for Becky if you're Buddy Miller. Or if you want to do a more gritty Mike Ferris kind of thing or something like that. If that's the kind of music you like that is you, then sure, develop that and go for it. I think ideally an artist does what an artist does. If the public likes it, that's serendipity. But an artist needs to do, a true good artist just does what they do to the best of their ability, and then it finds its own place in the world, whether that's on Christian radio or in a smoke-filled club or on a church platform. I think you need to do what you feel called to do. And I would, if I were counseling artists, that's what I would counsel them to do. Yes. Yes. Get those hands up so I can see them.
I'll take the next one.
My question is more like in terms of the industry, like in terms of like the Christian music festivals. Like I grew up in Northwest Pennsylvania, always going to like the Creation Festival, the Alive Festival. There's always one at Darien Lake and in New York. And I just wondered, like, how much of those help, like in terms of pushing, you know, whether they're just pushing the music, trying to just get the music sold, trying to just show like the actual community, like of buyers, like here's some new bands, go for these guys, and we're gonna throw the big bands in there too, so you come and look at them too. Like how much have those Christian music festivals actually helped over the whole sequence of, you know, Christian music being around?
They've helped artists a lot because they pay well. The economic engine of that is they want to put up a slate of artists that's going to draw a big crowd. The money there is made from the crowd who comes and pays the ticket. So they have to amass enough artists and speakers that people are going to want to come and see them. Now, in the process of coming there, if there's 70,000 people at the Creation Festival, they're going to be exposed to music they haven't heard before. But that's sort of a natural byproduct of the experience and not necessarily the intent. Although, touring is a great way to expose artists. And so when you go to a major artist concert and there's an opening act, chances are that act is not getting paid to play. Chances are better they're actually paying to be on the stage to be exposed to that audience and get heard. Because if you can get on stage with a major act who has 10,000 people in the audience, that's a pretty good shortcut to getting there. It's worth, you know, paying for. Our event that we do here in Nashville every spring, GMA Music Week, we have lots of showcases around town, every style of music, but we have virtually all of those radio stations here. They're in the audience, and every single artist who's on stage is paying us to be there. That's just the way it is. They're paying to be exposed to the guys who are going to play them on the radio or book them in concerts because all the festival guys are there and the concert promoters are all there. That's how that works. So it's a little bit different. There's no, yeah, record labels all want to get their new artists on these festivals. But the festivals book people who they think is going to draw crowds. If they don't think they're going to draw a crowd, they don't pay them. They'll put them on stage maybe. But they've got their own economic formulas that they use at long last. How are you?
How do you respond to the criticism that this music is theologically bad?
it from not a musical message and not the style or the quality, but in fact the depth of the thinking in this?
I would say generally that's a true statement. I would say it's a fair charge. No, I understand. I think, and there's some that's very deep theologically. I don't think you can actually beat the hymns for great theology in a very compact package. You know, we've lost that. I think, personal opinion, editorial here, okay? This is not GMA speaking, me speaking. A lot of these modern praise courses are just, you know, they call them 7-11 songs. You can sing seven words 11 times. And it's like a chant or a mantra, and they're not really saying much of anything, or they're more nihilistic than they are praise, and it's just kind of weird to me. And often they're not very good songs, you know. But that's just my personal opinion. So I think you could argue that a lot of popular rock songs aren't really good musically either. Three chords. That's it, you know, very simple and not great music, where classical music is so complex and great. So it's somewhat relative, but I also don't think a lot of these artists are intending to give you deep theology.
Let me follow up. So this is a group of theologians in this room. What would you tell us, what would be the role for this group of students or interested people to help with this question?
I think it takes all kinds of music. And by music, I mean music and lyrics, to reach all kinds of people. There's milk and there's meat. Some people are only ready for milk. Somebody's got to give it to them. There's young Christians and new Christians who maybe aren't ready for, they wouldn't get deep theology. Fortunately, there are people who are writing songs that have some theological depth, and for those who are ready to receive that, it's there for them. But in terms of the mass public, lowest common denominator, it ain't going to be deep. You know, because what's popular is generally not deep and not good. Primetime network television is probably an excellent example of that. Okay. Yes?
If we set aside Christian music and just look at rock and roll and folk music, and then we raise the same questions about authenticity or theology or what constitutes good or authentic rock or folk, I think that there's been a real difficulty in terms of industry co-opting the best voices, so that really those that stand out have been somewhat radical and have come from a tradition that cared about subverting the mainstream. So there seems to be a necessary commentary by the church that says, do we look more like bad folk and bad rock that basically is going to be co-opted, whether reinforcing the status quo or having incentives that are money-driven, or do we take the best out of what we're seeing here in folk and rock, whether they're Christian or not, as being subversive, important voices in society, and actually learning from that, and looking again at Christ and wondering, you know, what does it look like to follow Christ? What is authentic perception? What does theology look like in action, as opposed to maybe a package message that take and actually co-opt the subversive subculture and use that culture for their own means? So I think there's maybe a deeper level to examine.
Totally agree. And I don't mean to be flippant at all, but that's not very commercial. You know, that the whole idea of being subversive, our Southern Baptist friends aren't looking for that. They don't care about that. They just want to they want to be inspired. They want to feel good when they hear it.
Like someone like Keith Green or Larry Norman.
They were subversive. They shook up the system.
And they're also still today. And there's a reason why I know their names. And I bought, actually, their albums. Because they think that it does sell. And I think, so getting beyond the market, even though I think you can justify in terms of the market,
In both those cases, those guys were incredibly good songwriters. I mean, Keith Green was a radical, but he was also a really good songwriter. Songs endured. And they hit a place in the culture. They were difference makers. I had a conversation with an artist one time, put out an album, I reviewed it. He was a very well-known artist, and I've even named him tonight. And I wrote the review, and he was mad, called me up, you know, and I said, well, you know what, man, I've got 20 albums on my desk, and most of them make zero difference in my life. But a Keith Green record is an essential record. It makes a difference. It's essential. You have to have it. And he hung up the phone, and I heard an interview with him later. He was on, someone was interviewing him, and says, this is like 2 years later. He says, so, man, when are you going to have a new album out? I was talking to this cat, John Still, one day, and he said, you know, if it doesn't make a difference in my life, I don't need it. So I'm not going to make a record till I have one that makes a difference. It took him 7 years.
There's also something about Keith Green where the internal struggle, some of the talented folks like Dylan and Lennon, where he was giving away his, you know, giving away his records for donations to people, and he sent that into his branch where he stole the homes people. So, you know, there's something to be said about integrity of the individual and that person's mission, and not necessarily just kind of saying, well, people are making a living here, but taking culture more seriously, taking relationship between culture and industry.
I agree with you, and I think that's the ideal. I mean, I wish everybody would do that. That would be great, but not everybody's going to do that.
The
church is very vapid and shallow, in my opinion. Don't quote me on that. But if we're being real here, yeah, podcast. Thank you. Hello. It's my evil twin who said that.
I can't steer people, can
you? Yeah. Did you have a question in the back?
Yeah. Earlier, we kind of mentioned a split kind of in the Christian music industry, whereas most of the Christian artists now are doing strictly praise and worship artists, and you have people who just want to, or Christians who just want to make music. Is there any, obviously, the Christian record labels are adapting to the praise and worship and pushing that. Is there any kind of like effort on
Yes, and there has been for a while, in that they all now have mainstream counterparts. They're owned by mainstream companies. There's an internal hookup where, because virtually every band who comes to Sparrow Records says, I really want to do just mainstream. We're Christians, so we're here at Sparrow, but we want you to hook us up on the mainstream side. The problem is most of them aren't good enough to really make it over there, although the Christian audiences are quite a bit more accepting. But yeah, they want to do that, but it's not really their forte. Sparrow Records does not have the hookups at mainstream radio. And they do it retail, but mainly through their mainstream counterparts. So when Jars of Clay broke, that album was released on Essential Records through Provident, but the radio release came out on Silvertone, I think it was, through Zomba. It wasn't even on a Christian label. DC Talk, when they were getting mainstream, they were out on Virgin Records in the mainstream market and Forefront Records in the Christian market. So there's a lot of intentionality about doing that, but honestly, there's so little material that is really will work in the mainstream because it's inclusive in its message that there's not much that really goes there. And in the mainstream, we had this discussion earlier, or Dave was telling me about Randy Stonehill had an album and A&M wanted to take it out there. But they found out he's a Christian artist and therefore must have an agenda, and we don't want to be part of that agenda, that Christian preaching kind of agenda. We don't want to do that. We're a rock and roll record company. We don't want to do that. So you got this whole anti-Christian thing that happens too out there in the marketplace that is hard to deal with. They all want to do that. They all want to get out there in the mainstream. All labels right now are fighting for their lives, though. They'll do anything to try to sell some records. Not anything, but, you know. Yes?
On that, could you speak more about what kind of brainstorming is going on with respect to, I guess, the assault from the internet and the piracy and, you know, how the industry... I mean, I've heard, honestly, I've heard the basically just about like 14-year-olds getting... and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's the sensationalism that I've heard. So, I mean, what new marketing strategies and things like that have?
The music industry, the RIAA, which is the Record Label Trade Association, has been able to identify egregious violators of P2P services. In other words, they have web crawlers, and because you have these sharing folders. I know none of you actually know about this. It's all theoretical to all of you. They can look and see on people's hard drives what they have, and the threshold is 1,000 songs. They've got 1,000 illegally downloaded songs. They'll go try to find their, they'll get their IP address and subpoena them. To create awareness to the American public that it's illegal to do that. They could sue them for hundreds of thousands of dollars. They're suing average for like $3,500 is what they're selling for. It's a slap on the wrist to say, don't do this anymore, to get the message out to people that you could get caught and it could be bad for you. The industry, frankly, doesn't know what to do. They've got an old business model. They've been used to selling songs in bundles, which is what a CD is. Instead of buying one song, you sell 10 or 12, whatever's on there. Now, because, and I think the fatal decision that was made was to allow iTunes to sell any song as a single. When Universal Music Group, podcasting, think about this. Think before you speak, John.
We can edit.
There used to be a strategy of singles and albums. You would release a single first. It got on the radio. People liked it. A second single comes out. Then the album comes out. People go, oh, I like both the songs. I'll just go buy the album. That worked fine. That was good. And you couldn't get every song in the album as a single. And on some albums, you know, Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven was never released as a single. Never. If you wanted Stairway to Heaven, you had to buy the album. Now you can buy it just the song, I think. I don't think iTunes, just about every single, there's very few artists that have a bundled album product there. And a few have held out. Garth Brooks and Beatles aren't available on iTunes because they will not unbundle their albums. You know, you don't buy for the benefit of Mr. Kite from Sgt. Pepper's. You buy Sgt. Pepper's, for crying out loud. The fatal decision was to allow people to buy songs one at a time. Dramatically reduce sales volume. Labels are all about going digital. They'd be happy to go all digital. They are not anti-digital. But what they are is anti-not selling enough music. You know, and the new system has made it really, really hard. And they've got hardwired systems. They've got these big warehouses with conveyor belts and big racks of shelving and forklifts that they're having to downsize and dismantle. And that's just tough. It's expensive. It's a very painful and expensive transition that's taking place, but it's taking place and they're adapting to it. But you got to keep in mind, 75% of music sales today are still physical. Everybody's talking iTunes and digital, that's the big thing. Still 75 to 80% physical product is selling. Now that 75% ain't what it used to be because the business continues to shrink. But nonetheless, it'll be a while before CDs go away, if they ever do. Yes?
I understand that we're not in an ideal world, which is fine. But ideally, I'd be interested to hear what you would like to see, kind of picking up where Dr. Jensen left off, what you would like to see happen in terms of in a body or institution or something that encourages a more thoughtful, reflective, theological dialogue concerning Christian music. That could be sort of a voluntary governing board or a nonprofit magazine. And those things I know are out there, and a lot of them have already died in the process of. But it seems like there's this sort of there's this foundational sort of, I guess, ecclesiological question that that we're the church and we're this machine is sort of happening and it's governed largely by the market and we all understand that. But is there some way that we could be more proactive and helpful in this process? I'm trying to word this carefully so as not to demonize. I like to sell CDs too.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple things to say about that. First of all, I think the customer is king. The customer drives all of this stuff. people are going to do what people want to buy. People are going to buy what they want to buy. I mean, that's just sort of the way that works. And if they want to buy shallow, trite, cheesy stuff, then you know what? People are going to make plenty of it for them to buy. That is just the way our consumer culture works. On the other hand, we, for example, have a training camp we do every year for songwriters. And we try to teach people to write songs with depth and authenticity and hopefully commercial appeal. But we bring people in who do try to teach that. On the other hand, I think the church has a responsibility to teach people theology, and so that people can recognize bad theology when they see it. Because most people don't. They just take in this stuff. I mean, look at what you see on religious TV in terms of the preaching. You want to talk about some bad theology? you know, it's customer's king, and people are going to do what sells. And then those who, you know, who want to be more authentic and all that stuff may have to sacrifice some sales. Or in the happy case that happens with a Keith Green or some of those guys where the two converge and you have something that's authentic and deep and it connects with the consumer, fabulous. Unfortunately, too rare. We try, and it's certainly not a perfect system, the Dove Awards. You go, oh, it's a Christian Grammy Awards, who cares? But it is intended to be a recognition of excellence. These are the songs that are really good. You know, it doesn't always work out that way, and everyone's going to quibble because one person's good song is another person's bad song. Because we all have our own individual tastes. We all have our things that we think are good. And if everybody thought like we did, the world would be a better place. But, you know, it's intended to, we do try to do those things, but it's hard to legislate that stuff or have a body that sets the standards for what, you know, it ought to be, I think.
On the standard, I feel like I had a moment when I needed to tell myself, make a separation with Christian product, and in my mind I always say that which is successfully advertised as Christian, rather than letting anything be described. And similarly, I needed to kind of stop believing in the secular as a category. The merely secular. And
right.
One thing I tell myself and say aloud sometimes is there isn't a secular molecule in the universe.
Right.
And that, I feel like I got that from hearing Madeline L. Engel say, when asked, how can you tell if art is Christian? She said, if it's good, it's Christian. Which seemed really, was very, very helpful to me. Because it did a kind of all truth, God's truth.
In a perfect world, there would be no Christian music.
Okay.
There would be good music, and there would be bad music. I mean, you can't. It's not that black and white.
Yeah.
But I think all of us probably listen to all kinds of music. We listen to music that we think is good for us, that entertains us or does whatever we want music to do, recognizing that we want music to do different things at different times. You know, I don't really want to hear Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin Sunday morning in church. But in my car driving home tonight, I just might.
Can the Gospel Music Association reward or affirm music that does not advertise itself as Christian?
Yes, it can, if it fits lyrical criteria. Because if you get into just saying good music, then what's the distinctive? CCM Magazine, we tried to do some of this, and we gave... U2 was one of our Joshua Tree or something was one of our big albums of the year. We made MTV News that year because they thought it was so odd that we would name U2, a secular band, one of the top Christian albums. Like, what? Made the news. And with the Dove Awards, we really wrestled with this years ago when Amy Grant came out with Baby Baby. You could say good song, good biblical values, want to love you with the sweetest of devotion. It's all, you know, biblical values. But there's nothing specifically Christian about it. there's a ton of songs out there that aren't specifically Christian that are good songs by people who are heathens or whatever, that would, if you listen just on song, what makes this song qualify for Dove Award and not this one? So we have to have some, we're not saying if it's not in our process, it's not a good song. We're saying these are the best gospel songs, and to some extent, we have to conform to society's belief of what a gospel song is. That makes sense. So, yeah, I don't believe in this compartmentalization of life. I believe like you do. There's no secular molecules. Therefore, all of life to the believer is Christian, and you take in those things. And in, I don't need Christian music. I just need music. And some of it's going to reflect my faith, and some of it's going to just be good music. But our marketing culture and our consumer culture almost demands that it's that way. That is the way the culture works. So to function in the culture, you conform to it. And that's what's happened. I think it's unfortunate. And I think we help create that to some extent, which I'm not happy about.
One more question?
Yes.
How much does the artist's lifestyle influence how they are recognized and celebrated? And then, because I would say that, and so therefore does the GMA have a set of theological guidelines, principles, ideals that they follow in general, that you voted on in your board or whatever? Because I would say that there are specific instances where homosexuals who write really good music,
yes,
are not accepted or not, are no longer included in this world of Christian music, however they are Christians. People, you talked earlier about the Jonas Brothers being pure or clean in their lifestyle. So, but then I've heard things about DC Talk and oh my gosh, they're singing in a bar. How does that influence, and then beyond that, how does the GMA reconcile that in terms of their ideals, their set theological beliefs? Do you have those?
Good question. The marketplace takes care of that issue in terms of Christian radio and all that kind of stuff. They want you to be pretty squeaky clean. And if you've been seen, you know, if you're promiscuous, if you're not part of the community, and, you know, a really good example is Evanescence, who signed, their first record came out through Provident. They played at Provident's sales conference. Full-on Christian label. They knew what they were doing. Then they figured out, oh, this Christian thing is very restrictive. And so they came out with an interview in Entertainment Weekly with liberal uses of the F word. It took about 10 seconds for them to be gone from Christian bookstores. And no longer distributed by Provident. Maybe 9 seconds. And for them, it was a very deliberate goodbye. They did that intentionally. The writer of that article used to write for CCM, by the way. Anyway, as far as what's that?
You trained them well.
Yeah, good journalist. Just quote them accurately. In terms of the GMA, it's a very tricky issue. But we don't. We are a professional trade organization. It's not our place as a trade organization to comment on personal issues or spiritual issues with people in our community. And we've been dealing with this recently as a well-known Christian artist who just came out saying, hey, I'm gay, who wrote beloved songs at the church. And we were asked to comment on that, and we basically said no comment. We are getting absolutely castigated by the militant anti-gay Christian community who thinks we should have come out with a statement that we're taking away his Dove Awards and we are banishing him to the outer darkness forever. And we just said, you know, we don't have a comment. Because we can't comment on that. Because what I would say is, every single person who's ever won a Dove Award is a sinner. Every single person. No question about it. How can we differentiate? Well, you're a worse sinner than this one over here. And, okay, well, you're gay. That's, okay, that's a bad sin. But, you know what, you have a huge ego problem. So we're going to take your Dove Award away. Or you who wrote us this letter about the gay thing, you have some anger issues. You know, you just can't go there. Cannot go there. So we, in our process a couple of years ago, Believe by Brooks and Dunn was up. We're not casting judgment on whether they like whiskey. The song is what we look at. The song itself qualified because it was clear Christian content, even though they don't want to wear that T-shirt and would not want to be in the Dove Awards. You know, Carrie Underwood's Jesus Take the Wheel, same thing, it actually won the Dove Award. She's not in our community per se, but oddly enough, Christian radio plays that and seems to be ignoring some of her other stuff. And not saying anything she does is really bad, but what Christian radio does and all that is different from what we do. We're much more liberal.
Well, we're going to have to call it quits, John. Oh. Thanks so much for coming.
Hey, thank you, guys. You're a really thoughtful bunch. It's great. Enjoyed
really
the conversation.
Great. We got more than we could have ever imagined. Thanks a lot.
That's really a pleasure.